This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iranian Foreign Ministry summons the British ambassador to protest London's stance on the recent wave of unrest and riots across Iran. Ukrainian forces make major advances against Russian troops, recapturing dozens of villages in the south and east. And also in our headlines, the United States conducts separate drills with Japan and South Korea in response to North Korea firing a ballistic missile over Japan. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Iran summons the British ambassador to protest the UK government's stance on the latest developments happening in the country. Simon Shercliffe was summoned in response to the British government calling in the Iranian chargé d'affaires a day earlier. The UK government has accused Iranian authorities of violating human rights and cracking down on protesters. Now the foreign ministry says Shercliffe was informed that Iran strongly condemns the British government's meddling in its internal affairs. According to a top ministry official, the UK is resorting to false and provocative interpretations and making biased and meddlesome comments about what's occurring in Iran. The official said by doing so, London is siding with the scenarios designed by groups working against the Islamic Republic. The protests were initially sparked by the death of a 22-year-old woman after being taken in by police, but they soon turned into riots and vandalism. Canadian government has recently imposed fresh sanctions against dozens of Iranian individuals and entities over alleged human rights violations. That's as Canada itself has checked history of rights violations, including unlawful killings and crimes against Indigenous people. We discuss with our guests in the News Review program the reason behind Canada's latest move against Iran, with which it has no diplomatic relations.
Canada has imposed fresh sanctions on 34 Iran individuals and entities over alleged human rights violations. The sanctions list announced by the Canadian Foreign Minister includes 25 people and 9 entities, including English News Network Press TV. Now, this a week after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau pledged to impose sanctions on the Iranian government. And this is not the first time that Canada has come up with such measures against Iran, with which it doesn't have any diplomatic ties. Ottawa in the past also blacklisted around 200 Iran entities and individuals. Now let's get some insight on this. So joining me will be Charlotte Cates, international coordinator with Samadou and Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network in Vancouver. Also with us will be Tohid Asadi, academic and political analyst in Tehran. Good to have both of you. So Charlotte, I can give you a list of what Amnesty International has reported regarding rights violations in a country called Canada. It includes highlights Indigenous people's rights, investigations on allegations of racist violence against, for example, Mi'kmaq people. And then we have children in those residential schools in the story, and the mass graves that you heard about. And then we got lots of them, like the right to water, health, and housing. This is what Amnesty International is saying. For First Nation communities especially, discrimination, refugees and migrants' rights, women's rights, and you name it. And a country with such a record of human rights is now blaming other countries for things maybe considered much less important.
I mean, what we're seeing is the Canadian state, time and time again, follows in line with the interests and demands of the United States and U.S. imperialism. And, you know, that alignment is based on controlling the resources and the future of the people of Iran and the people throughout the region. And so this is the same reason why we see the Canadian government over and over and over again backing war crimes and crimes against humanity in occupied Palestine to the hilt, and using this weapon of sanctions against countries and people around the world in an attempt to essentially prevent countries and peoples from exercising their right to independent development and a positive future for their people. I mean, this is, sanctions are a war crime. Sanctions are an imperialist attack. And when we're seeing what's happening now, where the Canadian government is adding television stations, for example, like Press TV, to this list of sanctioned entities, this is fundamentally an attempt to prevent anything but the official side of the story from Western governments from being heard to people around the world, including people here who really have no interest in continuing to perpetrate these policies of sanctions, war, and imperialism around the world, let alone the ongoing settler colonialism and genocide against indigenous people that continues to take place on this land.
Okay. Now, Tawhid, tell us about the part of the sanctions also has been placed on Press TV, and this is what, for instance, Facebook and Google did also a while ago. So let's talk about that a little bit.
I think basically there are a couple of points regarding this new round of sanctions imposed by Canadian government against Iran, and what tops the list and actually grasped my attention could be analyzed and, let's say, summarized in three perspectives. First of all, we are observing kind of interventionist approach from the Canadian government pertaining to Iran, and part of these sanctions are really could be analyzed under this context of interventionism. And then the sixth point is that, as your other respective guests mentioned, we see that Canada is kind of blind obedience at U.S. foreign policy on the basis and on the very core of which we see this rancorous, hostile, obnoxious trajectory of, let's say, mindset and practice regarding Iran. And Canada, with no initiative, just follows the orders that are directed from Washington. And so this is quite shameful for a country that claims for subject matters like independence, like sovereignty, and etc.
Thank you so much for that. Charlotte Cates in Vancouver, Tawhid Esadi in Tehran.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says that his forces are making gains in southern and eastern Ukraine and have retaken dozens of villages from Russia. Zelensky says some of the territory is taken back in the regions of Kherson, Luhansk, and Donetsk. Russia has not yet confirmed the new advances by Ukraine, but the latest maps revealed by Moscow showed Russian troops had left many areas in Kherson and northeastern Kharkiv region. The new announcement by Zelensky comes only days after Moscow officially declared incorporation of Kherson into the Russian Federation. Donetsk also joined Russia. People in those regions voted overwhelmingly in referendums to join the Russian Federation. Ukraine and its Western allies, including the EU and the U.S., have called the referendums, quote, illegal and a sham. Well, the United States announces a new batch of military aid to Ukraine amid Russia's repeated warnings about the consequences of more weapons supply to Kyiv. According to a statement by the White House, the new package is worth $625 million. It includes HIMARS rockets, artillery systems, ammunition, and armored vehicles. During a phone call with the Ukrainian president, U.S. President Joe Biden has pledged to impose severe costs on any individual or entity that backs Russia's offensive. He also said that Washington will continue to support Ukraine for as long as it takes. Meanwhile, Russia's envoy to the U.S. has warned that Washington's weapons supply to Kyiv increases the risk of a direct confrontation.
The supply of military products by the U.S. and its allies not only entails protracted bloodshed and new casualties, but also increases the danger of a direct military clash between Russia and Western countries.
The Russian diplomat also said that Moscow perceives U.S. military assistance to Kiev as an immediate threat to its strategic interests. The latest package brings the total value of Washington's military aid to more than $17.5 billion. The European Commission signs off on a further 5 billion euros for Ukraine. This, as lawmakers demand EU leaders provide greater support for citizens experiencing a growing cost of living crisis. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
Gas, oil, petrol, electricity and food prices continue to soar across the 27-nation EU as the conflict in Ukraine shows no sign of abating and sanctions against Russia appear to be backfiring. EU finance ministers discussed the situation on Tuesday with senior European Commission officials.
The fall in confidence has mirrored the rise in inflation. You know that we have now a record high of 10% in the euro area last month.
Experts say there is a lack of coordination in dealing with the EU's energy crisis, and there doesn't appear to be a long-term strategy.
Joe Biden has also said, I can supply the European Union with gas, but there you see it, it's a capitalistic opportunity, because he didn't say at what price.
Some EU lawmakers warn of a looming unemployment crisis as businesses cut back. All the while, poverty is on the rise in the bloc.
We are facing a social crisis. We are seeing real wages eroded by inflation. Many are struggling to pay their bills. We need urgent action. These, as energy firms and banks make huge profits.
Millions of ordinary EU citizens are at their wits' end, but there seems to be no end of money for the Ukrainian government.
Yesterday I signed a memorandum of understanding with Ukraine for the next macrofinancial assistance of 5 billion euros. We will disburse the first part, 2 billion euros, by mid-October.
Many are questioning why we don't hear more from Western leaders about peace talks. It is clear that economically things will only get worse in the absence of negotiations to end the conflict. But commentators point out that wars are very lucrative for some. And in reality, they suggest, the US-led NATO alliance has nothing to gain from peace. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The United States has conducted separate drills with Japan and South Korea amid escalating tensions with North Korea. During the military exercise with Japan, U.S. F-35 warplanes flew with Japanese F-15 and F-2 fighter jets. Separately, U.S. and South Korean warplanes conducted bombing drills in the Yellow Sea. Seoul said its F-15 fighter jets, together with American warplanes, dropped a pair of guided bombs on a target off the country's west coast. The two countries also held a missile drill. They fired a barrage of ground-to-ground missiles into the Sea of Japan. Two short-range ballistic missiles were also fired into the water. The drills came after North Korea test fired an intermediate-range ballistic missile over Japan. That was the first time a North Korean projectile had passed through Japan's airspace since 2017. South Korea has warned of a decisive response.
North Korea's such reckless nuclear provocation will face resolute response from our military as well as our allies and the international community.
North Korea's missile test also drew angry reaction from the European Union. EU chief Charles Michel called the launch unjustified aggression and a blatant violation of international law. The United Nations also condemned the escalation. Tensions have been running high on the Korean Peninsula for months. Pyongyang has test-fired short-range ballistic missiles 5 times in over a week in retaliation for joint anti-submarine drills between South Korea, Japan, and the U.S. North Korea considers those maneuvers as rehearsals for an invasion. It accuses the U.S. and its regional allies of threatening it with war games and military buildups. A new poll is suggesting that the U.S. president's public approval rating has plunged ahead of the November midterm elections. The poll conducted by Reuters Ipsos shows that only 40% of Americans are satisfied with Joe Biden's performance. The respondents included both Democrats and Republicans. With nearly 1 month to the elections, the new figure is raising alarms. The Democrats may lose control of the House of Representatives as well as the Senate. According to recent surveys, less than 40% of Americans approve of the president's handling of the economy. The United States is facing high inflation, with many families struggling to cover their expenses. Biden's popularity hit a record low of 36% in May and June. The European Union always condemns Israel when it comes to its violations in the occupied Palestinian territories, including the regime's illegal settlement activities or abuse of Palestinians. But in practice, EU support for Israel remains ironclad. The EU's disregard for human rights and democracy has become even more blatant in recent years, which shows how its words of condemnations do not represent its actual notion of human rights.
When it comes to the relationship between the EU and Israel, one thing is evident. The EU comes out defending Palestinians and condemns Israel for its different violations, from settlements to the killing of Palestinians. But words of condemnations are just that, words. For when it comes to doing anything about it, it does absolutely nothing. There is a broad consensus that the EU is not an honest broker when it comes to Israel and Palestine, and that the very DNA of the Israel-EU relationship reveals that on Palestinian rights, Brussels only condemns Israeli illegal acts. Be it in response to the unfounded allegations in the 2021 dossier, which offered no proof to justify the terror label for Palestinian groups, or to the all-frequent military onslaught on Gaza, the EU has done little to hold Israel accountable besides ritual but ineffectual expressions of concern. In fact, the EU recently reiterated its commitment to developing closer diplomatic ties and agreed to resume meetings of the EU-Israel Association Council. Another sign of Europe's somewhat covert support for Israel is a memorandum of understanding between the EU, Egypt, and Israel, where Cairo is set to export Israeli gas to Europe. All this has also shed light on the West's double standards regarding the Palestine-Israel conflict, and this has only been further clarified through the West's support of Ukraine in light of the Russian special military operation there. The world rallied behind Ukraine and left Palestinians frustrated, who witnessed being criminalized and were constantly being told that they don't have the right to resist, or even labeled as terrorists or anti-Semites just for asking for their rights. Despite the long list of horrific human rights violations in Palestine and other atrocities in the world, the West is yet to display a unified response to the Israeli aggressions. But what makes matters worse is the West claims it supports human rights, like for Palestinians, yet it continues to do nothing when it comes to the Israeli violations of Palestinian rights.
If the EU was truly supportive of Palestine, then as a bloc it would have moved towards recognizing Palestine as a state. As of now, just 9 out of 27 EU member states recognize Palestine. This shows how the bloc does not advocate for a real change in its action against Israel, no matter the regime is committing atrocious acts against the Palestinians. It seems the EU doesn't want to go against Israel in order to preserve its own interests. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
The United Kingdom government, which supported the establishment of the fabricated regime of Israel decades ago, is now moving further toward the Zionist regime and its sinister goals. There are reports that new British Prime Minister Liz Truss has already promised Zionist regime Prime Minister Yair Lapid that she will review whether to move the UK's embassy to Al-Quds. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. The Electronic Intifada wrote, "It has been all change in the UK this month, where, in the space of a few days, the country got a new prime minister and then a new monarch. Mary Elizabeth Truss, or Liz Truss, as she is commonly known, except for the middle bit, only had to woo a majority of the Conservative Party's 172,000 paid-up members. She did so, securing just over 80,000 votes in a country with 47.6 million eligible voters. Clearly unburdened by the weight of any campaign promises to masses, Truss has started with some gusto after an enforced pause due to the funeral of Queen Elizabeth. Slashing taxes, reinstating bankers' bonuses, and generally reviving widely discredited trickle-down economies, Truss' opening gambit is so long on unfettered free market ideology that the Financial Times described it as a profound shift in policy for the UK. Such aggressive policymaking will have profound repercussions for Britons. Her eagerness to make bold moves could also prove harmful to Palestinians. She has already promised her good friend, the Zionist regime Prime Minister Yair Lapid, that she will review whether to move the UK's embassy to Al-Quds, following former US President Donald Trump's example. Indeed, Truss, who often gives the impression of having walked into a room without remembering why, was recently described by one Israeli newspaper as potentially the most pro-Israel British Prime Minister ever. Actually, Truss has got competition for that title. David Lloyd George gave away Palestine once the UK came into colonial possession. Winston Churchill was an avid supporter of Zionism. After British attitudes had shifted a little in 1930s, he was challenged over why Palestine's native population should not be allowed a say over the future of their own country. He told the UK government commission, "I do not admit that the dog in the manger has the final right to the manger," he recounted, "even though he may have delayed there for a very long time." The British washed their hands of Palestine in 1947, broadly supportive of the Zionist regime, that plucky little country in the aftermath of the Second World War. The 1967 occupation began to change attitudes, and it was not until 1986 that Margaret Thatcher, Liz Truss' political idol, became the first British PM to make an official visit to the Palestinian territories. Even there, Thatcher's relationship with the Zionist regime was complicated. She never forgot that it was Menachem Begin, by then her Zionist regime counterpart, who had ordered the bombing of King David Hotel in Al-Quds in 1946 that killed 28 Britons, 41 Palestinians, and 17 Palestinian Jews. Nor did she forget that Begin's Ergun parliamentary group in 1947 kidnapped two British soldiers and executed them by hanging. Her visit, nevertheless, marked a slow changing of the narrative in London. John Major was reluctant to meet the late former PLO leader Yasser Arafat for fear of the Zionist regime reaction. And while relations with Arab countries, international law, and two-state dogma largely informed the British position from then, the ground had been prepared for what is now becoming a full pivot to the Zionist regime. It started with Brexit and accelerated during Boris Johnson's time in office. The Brexit referendum, in which one side played hard and fast with the truth, has suited those in the UK who push an up-is-down pro-Zionist narrative. The manipulations and outright lies that characterized Johnson's time in office served a pro-Zionist narrative. Also helping the Zionist regime's case is a post-Brexit period of what can best be described as British diplomacy by desperation, having largely failed to secure trade deals to replace what has been lost by leaving the EU's common market. Notably with the US, the UK has been looking further afield. Last year, when she was Foreign Secretary, Truss signed a deeply unfavorable agreement with Australia. And this year, the UK is pursuing trade deals with the Zionist regime and Persian Gulf countries. It is not being held back from pursuing these trade deals by war crimes or other breaches of international law. The UK kept selling arms to Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, despite the appalling casualty count and evidence of war crimes throughout the Saudi-led seven-year war on Yemen, currently enjoying a truce. It is doing so despite the Zionist regime's many well-documented crimes over more than 70 years, from population transfers and ethnic cleansing to illegal land annexation and brutal military suppression. The fact that the British government believes it can pursue both deals at the same time also shows how the so-called Abraham Accords have shifted perceptions of what Britain can get away with in the region and the waning powers of the so-called Arabist at the Foreign Office. Indeed, during her leadership campaign, Truss tapped into the current British penchant for exploiting the struggle against anti-Jewish bigotry for political gain by accusing civil servants of anti-Semitism. Also warming every zealous pro-Zionist heart is a domestic agenda that includes an effort to ban local councils from pursuing their own boycott and divestment campaigns. The ban will primarily shield the fabricated regime of Israel from a growing boycott movement in the UK. A Truss government, therefore, looks set to shift UK policy away from its decades-old lip service to international law and into territory currently occupied only by the hikes and the likes of the US and Micronesia.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
It was reported that the UK markets lost £500 billion since Liz Truss took over. And then the British pound sunk once again against the dollar as the UK dived deeper into a recession. What is going on with the UK's economy? And is it all the fault of the new UK Prime Minister? That is what we'll be asking our guests in this edition of the program. Our guests joining us for this program are journalist and commentator James Tweedy, who joins us from Plymouth. Also joining us is political and economic analyst Shabir Rizvi, who joins us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. James Tweedy, I have this semi-technical question to maybe ask you, but I figured I'd just come out with a really, really simple question. What is going on with the UK's economy under Truss?
Thanks for having me. There's a problem with the economy, and it predates Liz Truss becoming Prime Minister, and that's the problem, as they call it, the cost of living crisis, which in other words is inflation. Inflation is running at about 10% now, and may rise still. And what that's been caused by the rising prices of natural gas and oil, which is driven by the sanctions on Russia over the, you know, its military operation in Ukraine. So, you know, this is, I mean, Truss bears responsibility for that because she was Foreign Secretary at the time that, you know, the time of the operation started, and she was always one of the leading voices for support for Ukraine and sanctions on Russia. And the Conservative Party knew, I mean, everyone knew that that's what she stood for when she was running for leadership of the Conservative Party and to become the new Prime Minister. Whereas her main opponent, Rishi Sunak, it was less certain, but there was people who hoped that he would take a more pragmatic view and ease off on the sanctions. But it's all become kind of irrelevant now because somebody, possibly across the Atlantic, has sabotaged the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines that carry gas from Russia to Germany and other places in Northern Europe.
Okay.
So we're very deep in the crisis now, and it's hard to see how we're going to get out.
Sure. And quickly, if you can, if you were to give a percentage fault to Truss for the state of the UK economy now, how much of a percentage would you attribute to her?
Okay. I mean, the question is whether the budget, the mini budget on Friday caused this. Well, you have the same, you know, the euro currency suffered the same slump in value against the dollar, as did the yen, the Japanese yen, the Australian dollar, and the Canadian dollar. And the difference is that the USA has energy security and Europe doesn't, you see. So I don't think it's to do with that. There's a problem with mortgage lenders have started changing all the mortgage products, you know, the mortgages that they offer. They've withdrawn lots of them.
Okay.
Yeah, that's because they offered a lot of fixed rate mortgages, and they don't want to do that anymore because inflation is so high, and this predates the budget, that the Bank of England is going to keep putting up interest rates. So, you know, of course, everybody is going to want to have their mortgage rates fixed for 2 or 3 or 5 years, like they used to be able to. But the mortgage companies, you know, they're like casinos. You know, the house always wins, right? You know, they set it up so the house always wins. Well, they don't want to lose out on that. They're going to pull those products.
Sure.
They pulled a lot of one where you pay a fee. You pay, like, say, £1,000 in advance, and you get a slightly lower interest rate. So you're paying your interest up front. But,
okay.
You know, that's based on a certain interest rate, and if the interest rate is going to go up, then, you know, the bank or the mortgage lender loses out. So I don't think it's to do with that budget. You know, the big thing is that the government is spending, it's going to borrow about $60 billion, they say, to pay for, to keep people's household bills down.
Okay.
In other words, to subsidize people's gas and electricity bills. So that's increasing government borrowing. And then there was a run on government debt bonds, you know.
Very well.
Like government bonds.
Sure. Let's bring in Shabbir Rizvi in here to get a little bit clearer, Shabbir Rizvi, about, or maybe you can tell us why this proposed tax cuts, which, first of all, depending on what publication you're reading, but it seems to be unanimous that it's going to benefit the rich more than the poor, why it has caused this domino effect in different sectors, not different sectors, in different factors that have pulled the UK economy into doldrums, as it's been reported. Perhaps you can explain it to us in layman's terms, of course.
Hello, good evening, Kaveh. It's really interesting times to be commenting as to what's happening to the UK economy. My day job is as a financial advisor, advising clients how to borrow money, how to invest their income, and so on. And it has been really quite a shocking week. It really comes after Mrs. Truss defended her vision for the economy, which has spooked markets and shocked most economists, mainstream economists. So, you know, everyone is really quite intrigued as to the policies that have been implemented. And then, of course, this week saw, yes, there are factors that other currencies have also fallen against the dollar, but this week the pound touched the lowest value ever against the dollar. You know, dollar which was invested 250 years ago, and the Bank of England are so alarmed that they poured billions into the market. Why they did that? Because a lot of money, pension funds are invested in it, and they didn't want the pension funds to collapse. Interest on government borrowing goes from almost 0% to 5% in weeks. The IMF is also spooked. The Chancellor dare not publish the report of the independent experts. It's expected to be published sometimes in October now, and he was sort of pushing it forward for end of November. And what we are told, the mantra we are told, is that don't worry, say both Truss and Kutang, an age of prosperity is just down the road. We've been living for the last 12 years in the age of austerity, where the rich have been getting richer and the poor have been getting poorer. And really, you know, it's really extraordinary, you know, for the last 40 years, the neoliberal economist mantra has been to say that trickle-down economics, meaning that make the rich richer, therefore, some money will trickle down to the poor. This is what I like to sort of dub as voodoo-nomics, not Reaganomics, not Thatcher-nomics, not Trussonomics. It's pure voodoo-nomics. There is no fundamental basis that by reducing 5% tax on the wealthiest would sort of somehow make the poorer better off. It's absolutely sort of outrageous. It has no basis in a sort of, you know, conventional economic thinking. It's an It's an economy based on ideology.
Well, that's
the Tory party, as I said, has made richer in the last 12 years, and they want to continue to do so for the next 2 years that they're in power.
Well, James Sweetie, that's pretty much what our guest there, Shabir Rizvi, has said, is what many economists agree, and that is that trickle-down economics doesn't work. Of course, it depends on who you're talking to. At the same time, we know that Liz Truss has said, this is not going to make me a popular prime minister, but I'm going to go with it anyways, and she has actually embarked on this and is not going to shy away from it. If she knows that it's not going to work, based on what it has, what economists have said, or other analysts have said, she's very steadfast in going through with it. What do you think the reason for that is, knowing that many have said trickle-down economics doesn't work?
Well, conventional economics, as taught in the West, is voodoo, that's for sure. But it's very strange to see the same people who said that trickle-down economics really does work, you know, laissez-faire economics is great for decades, and now saying it doesn't, you know, the same people. And, you know, the Tories have argued, and they can back this up, that cutting corporation tax actually increases tax revenue because you get more investment. Now, whether that's going to keep working, because it has in the past, but whether that's going to keep working in the current crisis, which is not, you know, which is caused by an external factor, then I don't know. You see, you can't tell.
There might be an external factor. We're going to get into that, and I'm going to ask both of you whether that's the case.
I'm going to say, look, in Marxist economics, you need a capitalist to employ people. That's what creates jobs. You need capitalists, bigger capitalists, more capitalists. So yeah, it kind of works. But you know, what's going on is that, you know, again, all the economists said the free market was sacred, and now we have this immense distortion of the market, of the free market, by putting embargoes and sanctions on Russian oil imports, and now blowing up the pipelines, the oil and gas imports, and now blowing up the gas pipelines. You see, so yeah, that has, and of course, that distortion has created an economic crisis, because the price of gas has gone up like tenfold in 2 years. So, you know, there's all sorts of things going on here. That, you know, what's going to happen? She's going to be unpopular, because a lot of the things that were in that budget would be popular with the people who vote Conservative. They're reducing taxes, including on the basic rate of tax for people that most people claim, right? They increased the threshold where you pay stamp duty, which is a tax on buying a house. So many more people will be exempt from that, because the threshold is now $500,000. And all these things, that was all sort of bread and butter stuff. But now what you're going to have, apparently there's a fear that the house price, the house market, the prices of houses will crash. So people who own they don't own them, they're paying mortgages, but, you know, people with property, the value of their property will fall, and they will be unhappy about that.
Sure, sure. Let's,
but the thing is that the house market here is ridiculously overheated. To the extent everything is overpriced, people can't afford to buy.
Okay.
It needs to come down. And half of the properties on the market you see now, they're being sold at auction, which means that the only people who can buy them are big-time landlords who've got that much money in the bank to pay as soon as when the auction is over.
Let's move to that external factor that I'd like to ask Shabir Rizvi here, that maybe a reason, and a very good reason, for Liz Truss, to Shabir Rizvi, to have introduced this tax cut plan. When she was running to become the prime minister, she, during one of the sessions that she was presenting herself to the Friends of Israel, obviously displaying how much she supports Israel in so many ways, but said that the trade deal with Israel needs to be revamped. And she was very quick, when she came into office, to go ahead with that and finalize that, at the same time making the announcement that she's going to have UK's embassy possibly move from Tel Aviv to Al-Quds. Now, it's very interesting that that would be at the top of her list, the trade treaty to be revamped. Do you think that she's made promises to Israel, as an example, that you're going to get tax cuts, come and invest in the UK, and let's revamp the treaty that we had before? So she has to follow through with these tax cuts for the corporations, for example?
Well, look, you know, the Israel angle is interesting, but I think it's very clear, if you look at it, wherever Israel is participating in economic activity, they really don't invest that much. They want more money to come into Israel for investment, whether it's technology from the the Silicon Valley in the USA, or whether it's Indian investment into armament and biotechnology and other areas. So I don't know what benefit that would derive to the UK. But at a broader level, the mantra that is being sort of fed to the public here in UK, as you know very well, is that it's due to Putin that the oil prices has gone up. It's due to Putin that we have high inflation. Food security is being sort of put on the special operation in Ukraine. So everything that is happening to the British economy, the Tory government does not want to take and be honest, saying that they have inflicted austerity for the last 12 years on the British public. And this is an aspect of that austerity, so that the poorer become poorer, and is being sold to the public that, you know, tax is being reduced and so on. You know, 1% reduction in what is called national insurance tax here on, say, someone average salary earning here, 25, 30, 40,000 pounds. That's only £400 per year, that 1%. While the top 1%, 700,000 people in UK who would benefit by the 5% reduction in income tax, if someone is £100,000, £1 million a year, that's £50,000 extra in their pocket. So again, as I said earlier, the whole concept that if you make rich even richer by way of other instruments, whether it's a reduction in personal taxation, corporation taxation, and other aspects, will make the wider society cheaper. But if I may just continue for 1 minute,
sure.
That, you know, the policy that's being portrayed by Truss and her team and Mr. Kwasi Kwarteng is to make Britain less regulated. But dare I say that for the last 40 years, probably Britain is the most deregulated country in Europe at this moment. I don't know how far deregulation will go. Does it mean that a serfdom would come back into the UK like it was in Victorian times? Is that kind of a unregulated market that the Tories want to have in the UK?
Right.
And, you know, ideas are being touted that they want London to be the Singapore on the Thames, unregulated, you know, for the wealthy and the rich, and absolutely regulated for the poor and the disenfranchised.
Sure. Well, I'm not too sure if that's going to work for the UK there, James Tweedy, when you have even the International Monetary Fund coming out. And this was surprising when the IMF comes out and makes a statement saying that what fiscal measures Britain is adopting is actually going to increase inequality, are urging UK authorities to reconsider providing more targeted support instead to affected families and businesses. Now, why would the IMF come out making that statement? First of all, wasn't there inequality in the UK before anyways?
The IMF is responsible for, you know, the continuation of colonial and post-colonial inequalities in the world, so they should know about inequality. It's actually baffling why they're saying that, why the White House is saying that, why the White House is even talking about it. Like it's their business, you know. I've never heard the U.S. government interfering in Britain's economic affairs before. I think, you know, like I say, it all comes back to inflation and the sanctions on Russia. That's not going to change. And yesterday, the shadow defense minister, Labour Party MP for Healey, said that the government will change. He's very sure of that. I'm not so sure. But and the Labour Party will be in power. But the policy toward Ukraine will not change. And he said that anyone who says stop the war is playing into Vladimir Putin's hands. So he's just as militant against Russia and for this war in the Ukraine as Liz Truss is, and so is the Labour Party. You see, so nothing is going to change. In fact, none of the parties in Parliament are proposing a different policy. So the crisis is going to continue. We have this. Both the main parties are talking about sort of moving the deck chairs around on the Titanic in order to try and deal with the problem of gas and therefore electricity prices, oil and therefore electricity prices and every other kind of price going through the roof. The conservative way is going to be to borrow money to give to people to pay their bills, but those people will have to pay that money in the end, in the future, through taxation as that debt paid off, probably after the next election. The Labour policy is to put a windfall tax, as they call it, on companies like BP, British Petroleum, that produce the actual gas and oil and are making much bigger profits because of the global market price being very high now. But then they'll pay that money straight back to those companies as a subsidy for people's bills, you see. So those companies will make the same profit twice, and they'll continue to make that profit.
We got 30 seconds left, so I'm going to jump in. I'm sorry, and ask Shabir Rizvi the question. Shabir Rizvi, I was trying to look at the ways, different ways that the UK is spending money. 500 billion pounds, I believe, is what's going to go for the energy issue. You were looking at another 500 million for the Ukraine war. These are just recent acts. And there was another 500 million. I don't know why this 500 is a figure that is repeated, where the UK has promised in another area, which I'm not coming up with that figure right now. But these are big chunks of money. Where is this money coming from that Liz Truss believes that it can just invest in different areas or to allocate in different areas when the economy is doing as bad as it is right now? 30 seconds only.
Well, famously, Theresa May said that we don't have money tree. But the reality is that the government sort of plants new money tree as and when required for their purpose. But when it's sort of, for the National Health Service, for the improvement of the education sector, where students don't have to pay fees for their university degrees.
Thank you.
There's no money available.
I thank you for that, Shabir Rizvi. I do apologize for jumping in. Political and economic analyst there from London. Thank you, Shabir. Also, journalist and commentator James Sweetie from Plymouth, UK. Thank you so much. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For me, Kavit Takwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamate began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali,
peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mahdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the ninth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the testamentary trustee and the ninth successor to the Holy Prophet Muhammad. He was also the testamentary trustee and the only successor of the eighth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn Musa ar-Ridha alayhi salam. Scholars, jurisprudents, narrators of traditions, and learners of wisdom and sciences came to Imam al-Jawad to drink from the pure fountain of his sciences and cultures. Jurisprudents have reported much from Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam concerning the various verdicts of the Islamic Sharia, worships, mu'amalat, the different business dealings, and other branches of jurisprudence, and all have been recorded in the encyclopedias of jurisprudence and hadith.
Parts of Ziyara texts of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Peace be upon you, O shining lights. Peace be upon you, O rising full moon. Peace be upon you, O pure one from among the pure ones. Peace be upon you, O immaculate from among the immaculate ones. Peace be upon you, O pleased and pure. Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious, the faithful leader, and Allah's mercy and blessings